How have our expectations for marriage changed over the course of history?
Around 1850 or so, you start to see a movement where people start to care a lot about personal fulfillment. That is, marriage became, it went from an institution where people were workmates to an institution where people are soulmates.
We talk more about modern marriages and how to make them better with author Eli Finkel. Plus, a conversation about the Stephen Sondheim musical Assassins. Here's director J.W. Morissette.
What does it take for somebody to reach the point where they feel assassination is justified, whatever their worldview may be? What does it take to get them to that? And the musical aspect sort of opens us up a little bit for that.
And only a few people ever have a building named after them. What about a new species of butterfly? That's what happened to Emily Grassley from Chicago's Field Museum. That's all coming up on this encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Valentine's Day has come and gone, but there's really never a bad time to talk about what makes a good relationship. Back in February, I had a chance to speak with a professional marriage doctor, Eli Finkel. He's a professor of social psychology, management, and organizations at Northwestern University. He's also the author of a book called The All or Nothing Marriage. Eli Finkel, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the idea of analyzing relationships or marriage therapy, is this also solely a modern conceit? Did people in other eras worry about the quality of their relationships to the way that we do now?
Oh, nowhere near as much as we do now. I mean, one of the things that I find useful when I think about what marriage used to be like is I think about Abraham Lincoln's upbringing. So he was born about 200 years ago in 1809. And he was born into a one-room, dirt-floor log cabin. He had an older sister, and the four of them lived there together. There was another kid that came after that but died in infancy. When Abraham was nine, his mother died, and when he was still a teenager, his only remaining sibling died, giving birth to a stillborn kid. And I don't mention that, just for the sheer joy of it or even because it's such a distinctive story, but life was precarious, fragile, a couple hundred years ago. And so when people thought about what they were going to prioritize in a marriage, it wasn't this sense that we're soulmates or I want to marry you because you're my best friend. They married for very practical things, literally things like food, clothing, shelter. Those are the sorts of things they used to prioritize.
And you write about this, right, in your book, The All or Nothing Marriage, kind of tracing the pathway of how we came to what is sort of the modern American understanding. And you also talk about this. Do you think it's fair to say that we put more pressure on our marriages and relationships now than we used to, in a way? Because at one point, we're talking about survival, and that's obviously kind of the biggest pressure you could put on a relationship. But I feel like, how have things changed?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It's not really so much that we expect more today, exactly. It's that the nature of what we expect has radically changed. So as I was saying earlier, the idea, you know, you might sort of kiss someone and go off to work or whatever else, you know, the unit of economic production was the individual farmhouse. Both the husband and the wife worked together. It was like a dual person, one career household where they were just barely scraping by, and you better hope that locusts didn't ruin the crops this year. But over time, we've increasingly cared about more emotional and psychological sorts of needs. And so starting really with the rise of industrialization and, you know, say around 1850 or so, you start to see a movement where people start to care a lot about personal fulfillment through their marriage. And in particular, at least during that era, the major thing people prioritized was love. That is, marriage became, it went from an institution where people were workmates to an institution where people are soulmates.
And then that said, what do you think you're learning that people want from their partners these days?
Yeah, so with industrialization came this emphasis on personal fulfillment, and we still have that today. But one thing that's interesting is starting around the 1960s, we no longer thought that a love-based marriage was sufficient. So we still care a lot that we love our spouse. There's no question about that. But these days, in contrast to, say, 1850 or 1950 even, it's not strange to hear somebody say, look, you know, he's a wonderful man. I love him very much and he's a good father, but I feel stagnant in this relationship and I'm not going to stay in a relationship like that for the next 30 years of my life. And so these days we do still care about love in the relationship, but we also care about something more, something that revolves around self-discovery and personal growth. We want to be with somebody who brings out the best in us. And those sorts of expectations are interesting because they're very difficult to meet, right? So, and for this reason, the average marriage has actually been getting a little worse because a marriage that would have been fulfilling for us in 1950 falls short of our expectations today. But it also has an upside, which is when you're shooting for that additional type of connection, you place within reach the possibility that you'll achieve a level of marital connection that was unavailable in an era where people weren't even trying.
Right. So that must be why you write the best marriages. You write this in your book. The best marriages today are better than the best marriages of earlier eras, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. As the expectations shift and in fact rise with regard to these emotional and psychological sorts of needs, more marriages are falling short because of those lofty expectations. But at the same time, the marriages that are successful in meeting those expectations are fulfilling in a whole new way.
My guest is Eli Finkel. He's the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. Let's talk about, Eli, some potential solutions for marriage and relationships that may not be the best. And I should point out, you're not a therapist or a clinical psychologist, but what happens when couples come to your lab? Can you walk us through an example of what people might experience?
Well, we do a broad range of different types of studies. Here's an example of the sort of work that we do. We ran one multi-year study where we studied married couples, and we followed up with them every 4 months. And every 4 months, they wrote about the biggest conflict they'd had in their marriage over the previous 4 months. And then we randomly assigned half of the couples to do an additional writing task, an additional 7 minutes of writing, that ask them to think about that conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody. And what that procedure does is it gets you outside of your own perspective and helps you look at the relationship as a whole. And what we found is that people who did this additional writing task tended to have marriages that were, again, not radically stronger, but statistically reliably stronger than people who hadn't done this additional writing task, this additional task of thinking about things from the third party perspective. And so these are the sorts of studies that we tend to do in my lab here at Northwestern.
Well, and then you also sort of write about this. You write about love hacks, right? There's not quick fixes for every marriage, as you point out, because not every marriage should be saved. But there's one example you write about, and I wonder how much this gets to sort of the writing you were talking about, these couples doing celebrating together. Why is that an important thing for people?
So savoring successes is something that we as a field of research, like relationships research, we have underappreciated this for a long time. And I think that people in general underappreciate this stuff. We often talk about things like social support. So, you know, can I rely on you when I'm going through a difficult time? And in fact, if you think about when people actually get to a clinical therapist's a marital therapist's office, for example, it's usually when things are pretty dire. But we need to evaluate the quality of our relationships, not just in terms of normal versus bad, but also normal versus really good. And one of the things that we can do that can take a marriage or help to take a marriage from, you know, relatively okay to quite strong is being good about savoring achievements together. And if you wait until it's a monumental achievement, somebody gets a PhD or you have your first baby, right? You just won't be celebrating often enough. So couples that are pretty good about recognizing day-to-day sort of achievements, the sorts of things that might happen every, I don't know, week or two or maybe three or four, right? Regularly enough that you can crack a bottle of wine and say, you know what? This warrants a toast. Those people tend to be better about savoring things in their life and consequently enjoying each other more.
Eli, you mentioned kids. I wonder, when people come to you seeking advice, how often are kids involved in the mix?
I mean, quite often. I mean, you know, there's a lot of research about what the major areas of conflict are in relationships, and there are things that you might expect: money, kids, sex. Kids are complicated. They certainly are bundles of joy, but they're also bundles of sleeplessness and bundles of spit up and bundles of diapering. And so the arrival of the first kid tends to be a pretty disruptive moment for the usually relatively young couple. And, you know, one recent estimate that I saw suggests that among dual income couples, the average amount of additional hours a week that people are now working, if you consider the care of a child work, is about 33 and a half additional hours. And I guess I would say that's per week, by the way. And I guess I would say, you know, among your listeners who don't have kids, you know, where would you and your partner, you and your spouse, find those 33 and a half hours? And if you had to find 33 and a half hours to do things that are, yes, very loving and warm and nurturing, but also a whole lot of washing bottles and cleaning up spit up, you know, do you think you might fight a little bit more? And the answer probably is yes, if you're like most couples. Do you think you might have a little bit less sex than you used to? Well, if you're like most couples, the answer is yes. Do you think you might have fewer conversations that are deeply connective? Well, if you're like most couples, the answer is yes. And so I think one thing that's effective for a lot of couples is to lower expectations about the quality of the connection for a little while the kids are very, very young. And then once you're sleeping through the night again, you can get back to some of that more aspirational, high-level expectation of the relationship.
You also mentioned sex, and I feel like that's another big component, I imagine, of what people talk to you about. And I wonder, do you think that, is it the physical intimacy or the emotional that you think most people find lacking?
I mean, I think it's probably on balance equally both. Sex is linked to a lot of positive outcomes in relationships. I mean, you know, it's a little bit complicated to disentangle the causal direction because relationships that are good tend to promote more sex, and then more sex tends to promote relationships that are good. But yeah, one of the dangerous things that happen when things get chaotic in a marriage is, or in a relationship more generally, is we make less time for those little things that bring us together, the sort of connective tissue of a relationship. And one of the strongest forms of connective tissue in a relationship is physical intimacy, including, and perhaps especially, sexual intimacy. And, you know, sex, when it is going well in a relationship, is about as good as anything in terms of making the couple feel close and connected to each other.
I'm speaking with Eli Finkel. There's a story about him on the latest cover edition of Chicago Magazine, where he's taking readers inside his marriage lab. He's also the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. And Eli, what in your experience changes when we're talking about same-sex couples?
Not as much as you might think. You know, the slightly longer version of that answer is, I wish there were more research on this question than there's been, but the research that exists suggests that same-sex couples, so the work that has been done is on gay men, lesbians, and heterosexuals, and they compare those three groups. So there are, of course, other groups, and they have not been studied. But of the work that I am aware of in that space, the story is much more one of similarity than one of difference. And it turns out that just like heterosexual people, people involved in same-sex relationships like to feel loved and nurtured, and they benefit from having a good sex life, and they benefit from having a responsive, sensitive caregiver, a responsive, sensitive partner. And so you can focus on differences. For example, like the frequency of sexual contact is higher among gay men than among the other groups, and the likelihood of having an openly non-monogamous relationship is also a little higher among gay men than among the other groups. But by and large, once you're focusing on people who are in a relationship, the story of how people relate, the story of how the heart works, is overwhelmingly similar across the groups.
I wanted to ask you, Eli, your book came out last September, and a lot has happened in the past few months alone, just in terms of women's identities. I'm thinking not just of the hashtag MeToo moment, but also of our changing political landscape. And I wonder, do you see marriages changing because of this? Are you working on any new theories about this?
You know, it is a great question. And I have to say, I'm probably among the many who is like watching and learning in real time. I mean, this is a massive social movement, particularly the Me Too movement. But I think you're right. The broader cultural context here, it seems to be that a moment of you know, assertive female empowerment, I think, and hopefully the breaking down of some barriers that we've seen for a long time about women's ability to get all sorts of things, including justice in the legal system. In general, what we see these days is that greater egalitarianism is associated with better marital quality. That wasn't always the case. So there was a period there in the 70s and the 80s where more educated women were less likely to be married and they were more likely to struggle in marriage, like marriage was more difficult. But that was an era where women had started to adjust to the new sort of gender paradigm that started in the wake of the, you know, second wave feminist movement. But men really hadn't started to adjust. So men really weren't doing a whole lot of additional work around the household. And, you know, as the generations have passed, so I'm 42, you could talk about my generation or even the generation after mine, men are increasingly involved in the home, and that helps to offset some of the additional labor that comes from women being increasingly involved in the workplace. And as those trends have continued, we've seen that now it is the most educated women who are the most likely to marry and who have the strongest relationships. And so my hope is that what we're seeing with some of the female empowerment that we've seen in the last few months is another step toward gender equality and toward a really equal marital paradigm that will be, in fact, beneficial and helpful for both men and women and children.
Eli Finkel is a social psychologist at Northwestern University. He's the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. Eli, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was fun.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I did it because it is wrong for one man to have so much service when other men have none. I did it to bring down the government of Abraham Lincoln and avenge the ravaged South.
I did it to prove to her my everlasting love.
I did it to make them listen to Charlie.
I did it because my belly was on the fire.
I did it to preserve the Union and promote the sale of my book.
I did it so my friends would know where I was.
That's audio from the 2004 Broadway production of Sondheim's Assassins. There's actually been 20 assassination attempts, 4 fatal, on the 45 men who have held office as President of the United States. Back in February, the University of Illinois performed a production of Sondheim's Assassins at the Illinois Theater. During the play's final weekend, we caught up with director J.W. Morissette. In addition to being the director, J.W. is also the assistant head for academic programs in the theater department. Assassins first came out in the 90s, so I started by asking what first drew him to this musical.
It's interesting. Thinking about the original production of 1990, there was also an incredibly successful revival of 2004.
But I actually, Neil Patrick Harris, which is the audio that we were just playing
right
there.
Right, right. I was actually introduced to this piece way back when I was in college, so several years ago, before the original, just as the original production was coming out. And I became intrigued with the concept of that Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman, who worked together to create this piece, of bringing these assassins together. At the time, I was in an acting for the camera class looking at how television film works. And one of the things that we learned about scripts was that oftentimes for a TV show, you'll pick an interesting place, such as like Cheers, where there's a bar where lots of interesting people can come through so that you have a storyline that continues to develop. This sort of went in a different direction and took a lot of interesting people combined by a pretty horrific act and brought them together in one specific place. And that intrigued me a lot.
Well, when you think about it, and I hadn't thought about it until I saw the production, we do have sort of this morbid fascination. Americans do, probably every country does. But I think there is sort of this uniquely morbid fascination America has had with people who have tried to assassinate our president.
Yes, absolutely. I think it even goes further than that. I think there is one of the lines in the show that always pops into my head when I start thinking about this is a line from The Balladeer that says, Lincoln, who got mixed reviews, now, because he was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, only gets rave reviews. There's also a symbolic element that happens to this sort of fascination with the assassinations and the outcome and the afterwards and a sort of collective memory of where was I when I learned about this? What was I doing at that time? The other connection I have to the piece is really very tangential, but it was way back when I was actually just in fifth grade. I was asked to play for the Kennedy assassination anniversary. I was asked to play John F. Kennedy as a fifth grader and I actually got the part where they reenacted lying in state. So I got to be lying underneath an American flag.
That's what you, in fifth grade?
In fifth grade.
You had to play...
the body, essentially, of the president.
Wow.
But I remember learning all about the Kennedy assassination. And at that time, talking to my grandparents who had experienced it as adults and my parents who had experienced it as children, and the sort of universality of people's ability to recall the moment they found out united that storytelling. And of course, in a more contemporary sense, I think my generation, certainly we have something like the Challenger explosion, or we have something as unfortunate as the...
Which is just an anniversary of recently.
Right, yeah. Exactly. That these sort of epic disasters that indel themselves on our memory, they leave a mark. And when I learned there was a musical that talked about this same thing, I became really interested. It combined all the things that I was fascinated with.
I think that is an interesting point you make. And I was thinking about that in that line in the play that you mentioned about there's also something about the mythology of our country that when a president gets assassinated, we never talk about anything bad that happened in their presidency, which this production doesn't really focus on the presidents. It's really all the individual stories of the successful and unsuccessful attempts. But I do think that is the other side to maybe a little bit of the mythology that we have.
Sure, absolutely. I think the symbolic representation, I think, that is inherent in the office of the presidency, regardless of who may be in that office at the time, connects to an identity of America, be it stereotypical or be it non-inclusive. It still exists. And when we have lost presidents, you're right, there becomes a tradition of, while we may look back critically, we often exalt the person or the president that was lost in that process, and they become almost mythical in that. You can see that, not to give any spoilers away from the show, but we tie together the first successful attempt of assassin with John Wilkes Booth, who ultimately meets with Lee Harvey Oswald in a sort of imaginary scene to convince him to assassinate JFK. And that mythology is sort of handed directly onward and I think still continues.
So that's an interesting point because in a way I thought in the I was actually one of our producers and I were discussing this after we saw the production. He was saying, you know, it's kind of a leap of fantasy to see them all together. And I was saying, I actually don't think it is because there is a sort of legacy of the ghost of John Wilkes Booth that is whispering into the ears of all of these other people who decide to do this.
Absolutely. The interesting part for me is I came across a book called Assassination Vacation, which takes a look at some of the historic spots that assassinations were attempted in, sort of tongue-in-cheek look, but it's filled with some great history, and it's a wonderful read. And one of the things I realized was, while these folks seem to be disconnected by time, when we learn about them in history, they're under the title of assassin, and they're all lumped together in our history books. They sequentially usually start at the beginning and cover each of their experiences. And yet some of them are lost to us. I think we have a particularly Illinois connection with John Wilkes Booth and Lincoln. And one of the people that I think is lost to us a little bit is Charles Guiteau, who is a fascinatingly complex and often bizarre character from history that we don't learn a whole lot about. But we do in the musical. We get reintroduced to him.
And he's the one who he wanted to promote his book and become an ambassador to France.
He wanted to become the ambassador to France. There are records of him just showing up at the White House to demand that he was going to become the ambassador to France. And he has a whole, it is far too involved to go into, but a pretty sordid history of dealing with his identity, his interactions. They make some reference to it in the actual musical about last week he was a bill collector and next week he's going to be an insurance salesman. And I've often actually told the cast, I said, we need to do an Assassins Part 2, which just focuses on Charles Guiteau's life. It is filled with that much interesting information.
And so the tone of this, I think, is a fascinating one because it is a musical. And it does deal with there's some really dark moments in this also. There are executions. Everybody's walking around with firearms. When you were thinking about this staging, how did you handle sort of the tone and the juxtaposition of that? And of course, the fact that a lot of these people have mental illnesses. They're completely unstable.
You're incredibly observant to catch on to the idea that through a certain lens, musicals are sort of a bizarre creation. A group of people seem to be gathered, and then they burst into song, and they all know the same lyrics and the same music, and they all do the same dance, which, of course, seems completely absurd to talk about something as serious as assassination. But what it does for me is it first sort of makes just asking the question of what does it take for somebody to reach the point where they feel assassination is justified, whatever their worldview may be. What does it take to get them to that? And the musical aspect sort of opens us up a little bit for that. The other thing it does is that it makes the serious moments even more serious because we realized 2 seconds ago we might have been laughing at something that we thought was rather clever. And then we remember, again, the reality of what that action means and what the impact of those actions result in. And it heightens both sort of the kind of clever silliness that may exist, but also heightens the dramatic effect of what's happening. So we crafted for a very long time in the rehearsal process a way to make sure that we were, A, still being true to what the concept as we understood it from Stephen Sondheim's work, which is imbued with a lot of wonderful, clever, lighthearted moments, but that was mixed with the reality of who were these people. And I wouldn't say that somebody coming to see the show is going to get a history lesson on this is 100% accurate history just by the fact that it's a musical. But the essence of those characters are still there. And all of the cast were doing research into the characters they were playing. And for many of them, it was an introduction to much of the history of those names attached. And in their characterization, in their work as actors, they have paid great heed to who those people were and in some cases still are. Sarah Jane Moore is still with us, just recently released from prison, actually. So in some
she
cases...
She attempted to kill President Ford,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, so she was one of a follower of Charles Manson?
No, that was Squeaky Frome. But in this musical, Squeaky, because she also attempted...
So there's my actual history getting the knowledge of that completely messed up by my viewing of the musical.
And that's one of the clever takes is to put Squeaky, who attempted to kill Gerald Ford, and Sarah Jane Moore, who just a few short weeks later also attempted to kill Gerald Ford, and we stick them together. So history is not accurately represented in the final outcome, but the essence and the story of what was there is still present.
And so as we're talking about this, that juxtaposition with John Hinckley, and there's sort of his kind of main song, Unworthy of Your Love, it's a really serious and kind of scary part into when he's talking about Jodie Foster and why he did all of this. And then you kind of hear that in this ballad. So I wanted to hear that and then sort of juxtapose it with the way that his actual attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan is depicted.
Nothing. You are wind and water and sky. Jody, tell me, Jody, how I can earn your love. I would swim oceans, I would move mountains, I would do anything for for you. What do you want me to do?
That's from the 2004 Broadway revival of Stephen Sondheim's Assassins. So that's this song. And then the actual attempt, the assassination attempt, is kind of, it's funny.
Part of it is, what I have found generally to be true is if we seem to have contemporary knowledge or experience of the presidents that and they survived, Sondheim seems to have treated them with a little bit
of
a light
touch.
Right,
that's what I thought. I thought, oh, Reagan survived. That's why this is kind of,
right.
This is a lighter touch.
Well,
right.
And there are some lighter touches, but, you know, when we're talking about Garfield and McKinley, we're far removed from them. So I think there's a little more space, perhaps in Sondheim's mind, of what we're able to maybe make a little more fun of. But John Hinckley is certainly painted as a kind of isolated, disturbed individual. We have this Unworthy of Your Love song where he's claiming love for Jodie Foster, and in order to get her attention, he is going to attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan. And I think the other part we get some lightheartedness is that Ronald Reagan was sort of legendary for his reaction to having been shot. We know that there were jokes on the table about hoping all of the doctors were Republicans and him making fun of Hinckley's inability to actually kill him. And now we have learned through history that he was far more ill than we thought. But I have very vivid memories of pictures of him standing at the hospital room window waving out to his supporters. And we know later that history has told us, actually, he was incredibly ill. And it was amazing that he was able to even stand up. But that was not what we saw at the time. At the time, it was about it didn't work, and the Gipper is still there for you. So
when we think about this, it was written in the 90s. What additions did you make as an adaptation to our current day? I recall a pretty good Barack Obama impersonation for just the beginning for a little bit.
Well, let me tell you about that. We always have a sort of challenge in contemporary theater, in the modern theater, which is these wonderful cell phone devices that travel with us everywhere we go. And people forget to turn them off beforehand. And what we have sort of established as a norm is that there's a kind of disembodied voiceover announcement saying, please turn off your cell phones for the patrons. And we find that people tend to not even hear them and block them out. So we actually added what we call our pre-show announcement. Also for the audience's comfort, there's an opportunity to see that we will be using stage weapons.
I wanted to ask you about that in a moment.
And blank gunfire. But our actor, I said to the actor that's playing the proprietor, is the name of the character actually, who introduces us to our evening events, I said, why don't you go ahead and just see what you would write as the proprietor of the show to help the audience feel welcome and present. And the President Obama impersonation was something that he does pretty well. And he decided to give it a try, and he found a quote that really spoke to him. So he tied that all together. It's not really part of the show itself. Actually, we have made absolutely no alterations to the show itself from the version, the 2004 version. There was a song that didn't exist in the 1990 version called Something Just Broke. And the ensemble sings that right after the assassination of President Kennedy. And in the 2004 revival, they restored that song. It had been in the works, and it had come and gone from different productions over the years and finally became part of what is actually the legally licensed version of the show that you can perform in 2018. I think that song, Something Just Broke, is an important addition to the piece because, I can't prove this factually. If I had a chance to sit down with Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman, I'd love to have this conversation, but much of the kind of dramatic energy and fuel of the story comes from this ultimate assassination, which is framed as the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And as we have become more and more removed from that time period and have lost generations who have experienced it firsthand, this song, Something Just Broke, offers a sort of contextualization of the emotions of just everyday people about what happens when these tragedies occur. So while there is a little addition of Barack Obama, the body of the show is left exactly as it is meant to be.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about Assassins. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you. What a wonder is a gun. What a versatile invention. First of all, when you've a gun, everybody pays attention. When you think what must be done, think of all that it can do.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's audio from the 2004 Broadway production of Sondheim's Assassins. If you're just joining us, you've been hearing our conversation with J.W. Morissette, who directed a production of this musical back in March at the University of Illinois, where he's also assistant head of the theater department. Before the break, we were hearing about the disclaimer at the beginning of the show about firearms, and there certainly are a lot of prop guns in this show since it's about assassinations. So I asked J.W. Morissette whether that was a challenge for him.
Yeah, actually, it was a great challenge on several levels for us. So first of all, honoring what was in the script and what was requested of the script is there just are a lot of guns present in the stories and the actual histories. Guns make up part of that. In some cases, we fetishize those guns. They're in museums. We look at the gun that killed Lincoln and different weapons throughout history. So from a kind of multi-layered process, one of the first things is, and this is at the heart of what we're doing, is we're training the next generation of theater professionals. And having young students who have an opportunity to work with weapons on stage is a wonderful training process for them. So when they leave, they are ready for professional practice. They know what standards are surround them. And our violence coordinator and weapons master, Zev Steinberg, Professor Steinberg, has been working from the week before actually casting about how we were going to deal safely and instruct our students in the process of what the professional practices around the use of weapons on stage may be. The other layer is also what is the audience comfort? The show actually calls for over 40 gunshots in the show. And we have the wonderful privilege of being able to present Assassins in the Studio Theater, which is a smaller theater space in the Krannert Center. We don't normally get to do that with musicals. Musicals are almost always moved into the giant 700, 800-seat houses in a proscenium stage. To get to see this show in an intimate theater with just about 200 seats is a fabulous opportunity to see it in a different way. It's also a miserable opportunity to hear over 40 gunshots in a small space. So we found ways to cut that down. I think there are only actually 18 total gunshots in the show. And some of them are live and some of them are recorded so that we can control the volume. And we had over 8 different meetings at which we measured the sound volume of every single one of the types of shots that are available for the stage weapons. And these are stage weapons. They are not actual guns that have blanks in them or something like that. These are completely blocked and safe for stage use. But we brought in our audio technicians and our sound designer, and we measured the different volumes of each shot and came to the conclusion that essentially we have sort of cap guns on steroids in the space. So it's not overwhelming, and the audience isn't going to be completely deafened by the process.
After this, to the end of it, as I was thinking about this after I saw it, this was very entertaining, also incredibly unsettling because it's complicated and messy and horrible, which I think speaks to the power of theater and art when it's done well. But I wanted to ask you about the tone of this. Like, how do you see it? Do you see this as hopeful kind of production about America, even though there's an irony in that of people who, you know, this is the story of 20 people who tried to tear down the foundation of the country as well?
Sure. I see a great deal of hope in it because we're able to look back at the identity of the American dream and all the manifestations that it comes from. We had a great discussion with the entire production team just a few weeks ago. And one of the things that I can't remember which actor said it, but they pointed out that we started discussions about this show. This was over a year and a half ago, were discussions about this show. And one of the things that I had said at that time was that the assassins are now historical figures and mythical figures that we look to and we decry their terrible actions. We see them as awful human beings in some cases, and in other cases perhaps people are exalt them for the choices that they made. But fundamentally, they were Americans that had reached a point that said their dream was not possible unless this action was their next step. And when you remember that, we sort of talked about the fact that the assassins were of us and from us and part of us, And not saying that we're all assassins, but that these were people that seemed to be leading relatively normal everyday lives. I think
it's John part of Wilkes, our American story, too.
Right, exactly. And that story is not told often. You know, the character of Czolgosz, for example, who comes from an immigrant family and is a working class person who meets up with Emma Goldman and the teachings of Emma Goldman and all of the politics that come with that. But ultimately, he was suffering. He couldn't make a living and he was frustrated and he didn't know how to make a better world for himself. And we don't advocate for the use of violence, but we do make space for the stories to hear what are some of those underlying things that were lost to sort of the sort of shiny American dream story of, you know, you can do it if you work hard enough. Well, sometimes you can't do it if you work hard enough. And what do you do with that? So ultimately for me, it becomes hopeful because we ask that question and there is a voice there and there's a lesson to be learned from that. There's a great line in the show where the balladeer sings, angry men don't write the rules and guns don't right the wrongs. And I think that's a lesson. There's a lesson there is that we think this will make a difference and we'll make some big splash in the news and this will ultimately change everything. That's not always the result of those violent actions. And I think it's a powerful reminder of that.
J.W. Morissette is the director of this production of Sondheim's Assassins. He's also the assistant head of the Department of Theater at the University of Illinois. J.W., thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Five years ago, Emily Grassley was hired to be the chief curiosity correspondent for Chicago's Field Museum, in part because of her popular YouTube channel called The Brain Scoop. If you've ever watched it, you know that Emily's all about science, museums, and communicating all that work to the public in an accessible way. Back in March, she was recognized for her work in an unusual way. Scientists named a new species of butterfly after her. They're calling it Wahadra grasselia. We had a chance to speak to Emily back in March when this was announced. I started by asking her just how excited she was about all of this.
You know, it's one of those things where a lot of times, you know, we're very fortunate for our program to be so celebrated in a number of, you know, popular media awards and things like, you know, I was on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. And those things always feel really nice, obviously, but this is like a whole nother level of, like, recognition that, you know, having a species named for you kind of immortalizes your name in the scientific record. And it's a huge honor. I mean, it's probably the greatest accomplishment, like, or sense of accomplishment I think I've ever had.
Yeah, no, it's great. So, and I mean, how often is a species named after, like, you know, you were also the first chief curiosity correspondent for the Chicago Field Museum, but I think it's a great recognition of the science that you do. And I would remiss if I didn't ask you just the scientific question just about this species. What can you tell us about it?
Well, the interesting thing about this butterfly in particular is that it's only known from the single specimen. So, you know, there's a lot of considerations that go into naming new species, and this one in particular was found within a museum collection, and this is oftentimes how new species are discovered. I think we have an idea that scientists are going out and they're spotting a new insect and they're having a kind of a eureka moment when it happens, but the reality is that museum collections hold more new species to science. We're just waiting for people to come by and actually take a look at them who have that kind of expertise. And so this was one specimen as part of a larger collection that Andy Warren from the University of Florida and his colleagues were looking through the collection, and they were a little puzzled by it, right? They didn't immediately recognize it, which is, you know, a pretty good indication if you're a taxonomist that you're looking at something new because you're the world expert, right? So if you don't recognize it, then it might very well be new to science. And so, you know, they did the diagnostic research. They dissected the genitalia out of it, which is a very common way of determining one species from another, especially with insects.
I feel like that must be very small also on a butterfly.
Yeah.
Like, that's like microscopic work, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I mean, they've got to use very specialized tools, and I don't think they drink a lot of coffee that day.
Emily, you mentioned that this was found in a collection. This is probably a good time to remind people, how big is the Field Museum's collection? How much of the Field Museum is actually on display versus archived or stored?
So that's a great question. And in the museum, the Field Museum is a gigantic place. If you've been here, you know, it'll take you hours to try and see everything. I mean, days or weeks. But we have less than 1% of all of our collections on display to the public. And so we have 40 million other objects and specimens that are behind the scenes that we have scientists from all over the world come to visit and check out our collections. And we have scientists in-house that are constantly doing new and exciting research with them every day.
So for listeners who might not be familiar with the Brain Scoop, can you tell us about it?
Well, the Brain Scoop is our educational YouTube channel. I started as a volunteer at the University of Montana Zoological Museum back in 2013. And since then, just actually a few months after I started at the Field Museum, offered to bring me on board and bring my channel here to Chicago. And so in the last 5 years or so, we've created almost 200 videos that talk about these collections, right? Like, why do we have so many objects and what are we doing with them? And what's some of the exciting research that's coming out of museum collections? And so I mean, it's a real joy and privilege to be able to spend my time kind of being a curiosity correspondent.
Well, when I think about that, Emily, a lot of your work gets out there on YouTube and through social media, through sites like Facebook or Twitter. But you've been doing the Brain Scoop since like 2013. And I wonder, has it gotten, I don't know if it, do you think it's gotten more stressful over the years to do educational work around science because a lot of misinformation or wrong things also get spread very easily on social media?
Well, there's kind of two sides of that. One, educational content, in general, the sort of educational content we're doing isn't always going to resonate with like a viral, you know, public.
The
right?
Earth I is mean, flat, new... people.
Well, you know, it's because it's not necessarily sensationalized, but I don't know if that's the word to put it. But, you know, to be honest with you, like, we receive so much positive feedback. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I don't get thanked for the work that I'm doing. And, you know, when I go and give public presentations and engage with the people who watch our show, or even people who are just interested in science, I would have to say that the majority of people that I meet and communicate with are just genuinely interested in learning more about the world around them. And if you can kind of go into these educational moments with an open mind and, you know, a genuine curiosity about it, even if it's something that challenges your previously held beliefs or worldview, I think people are just interested in having a thoughtful conversation about it.
And Emily, getting back to the butterfly species, did I pronounce it correctly? Is it Wahydra gracilei? Is that correct?
It's like gracilei or gracilei. You know, my Latin's not good.
Right. What do you think it says for? I wonder how much an encouragement you think that is for young people, and I imagine even particularly young women in science, to know that if they do the kind of work you do, maybe they could get a species named after them.
Well, you know, I think it's one of those things where it's just kind of a humbling experience. Like it, you oftentimes when we're doing this work, we'll have a video that, you know, doesn't have quote as many views because it's about a nuanced area of science or research. But to know that like the people who watch it, right, these are other taxonomists who are grateful for the work that we're helping to do to popularize science. I do hope that sends a positive message that this work is really gratifying, and I hope that more people would be interested in helping to popularize science, just because it's a good thing to do.
Well, and it's a great honor for we like to celebrate people in Illinois' accomplishments. So congratulations. That's Emily Grassley. She's the chief curiosity correspondent at the Chicago Field Museum. You can check out the Brain Scoop on YouTube. We'll tweet out all of those links if you haven't seen it. We'll have it up at 21stshow.org. Emily, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.